Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, it's just you and me. We're going to dip into the archives this week. It's been a very busy week here at the station because of Spring Pledge. And I want to thank everybody who has contributed to WFYI and all things public radio goodness to support the local, national, and international programming that WFYI brings you, and even the shows that don't involve yours truly. But I do thank you for supporting Film Sociology, The Blues House Party, and yes, Stolen Moments, and Small Studio Signal Boost. I pop up there every now and then. Anyway, but it's never too late or too early to show your support to WFYI. Just a friendly reminder, WFYI.org/give, or call 877-930-0221, or text give. So yeah, 877-930-0221, or WFYI.org/give, and we thank you. New this week on Corneth Home Video is the documentary Why Is We Americans? Lauren Hill is an executive producer on this. She's also one of the talking heads, lowercase t, lowercase h. And this is a story about the documentary about the history of race relations in Newark, New Jersey, as well as the impact on Mary Baraka, poet, playwright, activist, and his family, and their intertwinings of the city and their activism. Going back to the 1967 Newark Rebellion, not a riot, they say, and all the way up to Amiri's son, who was elected the mayor of Newark, and he had run four times prior. So it is. And it's not about the election race. Early on, it seems like it is, but it isn't. But we get a nice interwoven story of this family, their impact on Newark, and the race relations in Newark, New Jersey. So very informative. I know Newark is a hotbed. It's still a hotbed. And it's worth checking out because we also get to find out about Amiri's family, the rock of their home, his wife Amina, and the kids, and the impact that they have had creating their own paths. So, look for Why Is We Americans on Corneth Home Video. All right, friends, we are going to dip into the archives this week. April 28th, I was reminded, social media use of good. That it's the birthday of the great musician Chuck Lavelle. Yes, the gentleman who is piano keyboardist, who's played with everybody from the Rolling Stones to the Allman Brothers, among others. And don't forget, there is a lovely documentary called Chuck Lavelle, the Tree Man, that came out last year. You can go to ChuckLavelleTheTreeMan.com for all the information on Chuck and the film and his impact. And also, because the film talks about not only his musical escapades, but his nature escapades. So, and I say that term lovingly. And I got to interview Chuck last year, and it was an absolute delight. And I get to, you know, this is one of the perks of having an archives, is I'm able to dip into the archives and share this interview with you once again. Now I'm sounding like fresh air. Go to WFYI.org/give or call 877-930-0221 to show your support for Film Sociology. If you've ever contributed to the grab a pencil portion of Film Sociology. Please show your support now. You can become a member, renew your membership, or to become a sustaining member. So WFYI.org/give, 877-930-0221. We now go into the archives from last year. Here's my interview with musician and nature dude Chuck Lavelle. Enjoy. So, Chuck, I know everything is like pre-COVID, post-COVID. When did Chuck Lavelle, the Tree Man, start filming, and then when did it finish? And was COVID a blockade as far as getting the film out and available?
Well, it was about 3.5 years in the making, and we kind of finished it up in late 2019. So that's kind of where we were at with it. We wanted to get it out in tandem with the Rolling Stones tour that was planned in 2020, but of course the whole world got nixed on any tourings, including the Rolling Stones. So, you know, the master plan didn't quite work out like we all wanted. Alan and I, my filmmaker, Alan Forrest, and myself talked about, you know, the options. Should we try to wait to put it out? And finally we said, you know what, let's just go with it. We don't know how long COVID's going to be around. The longer we wait, the more danger we have of losing interest in it. So let's just go ahead and do it. And that's what we did.
How did you and Alan get together?
I knew Alan from an artist that he was helping out. I think his name was Gerard, and he was a blues guitar player. And Alan reached out to me, this must be 10 years ago, to play on a session for that artist, which I did. And Alan was kind of managing this person and helping him out. And so we remained friends after that. We didn't talk a whole lot in between. And then fast forward to when we were touring with the Stones, gosh, I think it must have been 2016 or 17, and we were coming to Las Vegas to do a show there, and Mick got laryngitis. And Alan happened to be in Las Vegas doing another project, and he had called me to say, hey, maybe I could come to the show. And I said, yeah, I'd love for you to come to the show, but there's not going to be one because Mick lost his voice. And so we got together anyway, and in the conversation, he asked me what I'd been doing, and I told him I was entertaining the idea of doing this documentary, and we had actually interviewed a couple of other prospects at that time. And he said, really? Well, listen, would I have any chance of making a bid for this? And I said, well, sure, you know, we can open it up for discussion. And over the next 3 months or so, Alan just proved to us that he really wanted the project. That he wanted it worse than any of the other guys that we had interviewed, and was willing to go the extra mile to make it happen. And so we made the deal, and Alan was just great during the entire process. I mean, he got a lot of the historic footage that we use, of course, but he shot just about everything else we did himself. And that was a lot of work. And he just did a fabulous job. And then, you know, we got to the editing, and we had all these interviews, something like 80 different interviews, and we had all this raw footage. And I said, Alan, how in the world are you going to make sense out of this thing and make a story? And he said, you know what? This is what I do. Just trust me. And so he went into his basement for like 6 weeks to do the editing and working 8 to 12 hours a day. And voila, there it was. So I was just really pleased with the way it turned out.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I'm sure filmmakers would say the same thing about musicians and vice versa. I don't know how you know all those songs in your head, or, you know, all the editing techniques, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it was a process. You know, it was a lot of fun working with Alan. He's a smart guy. He had a really a strong handle on everything that he wanted to do, and we proceeded accordingly. And it was a really enjoyable project. I mean, lots of fun, lots of laughter along the way. But I have to tell you that, you know, once we made the deal, and Alan said, Chuck, you realize you got to make your best efforts to get these interviews to make these contacts. And I thought, oh, Lord, oh, God, what have I done? You know, now I've got to make the ask of all these people. And we wound up with a pretty good tag team methodology where I would either send an email or do a phone request, leave a message, talk to management, whatever, and just kind of pave the way and say, listen, this is what we're doing. Would there be any chance that you might be interested? And then Alan would do the follow-up about all the logistics and the particulars, et cetera, et cetera. And so it worked out in the end.
Well, yeah, I think it did pretty well since you had, I remember some of the talking heads, that's lower capitals, lowercase letters of, you know, Dickie Betts, Eric Clapton, the Rolling Stones. I think it turned out pretty good for folks to talk about you. I'm sure the time was tight, but mission accomplished.
It was indeed, and there was a lot of, you know, the time put in to make these arrangements and to get on people's schedules where it would work out. And one interesting thing that I'll pass along, Alan has, I'll call it a trick, but it's really a very smart piece of equipment. And that is, you know, usually when people are doing interviews, you'll see the person being interviewed looking off to the side to wherever the person asking the questions is. So, you know, you get kind of an angular shot. Alan has a device that is, for lack of a better word, is kind of like a periscope, so that he sits near the camera looking at this device, and it has a mirror, and the mirror shoots his face right dead center of the lens of the camera. And so that way people are talking to the camera, but they're talking to Alan, and it makes for a much more personable exchange. And I thought it just was brilliant. You know, it really helped, I think, a lot of the interviews to come to life and to look like they were talking to the audience, more or less.
Agreed. You mentioned earlier Mick getting laryngitis in Las Vegas. When it's a night like that, you're not going to do an entire evening of Keith tunes?
No.
You're not going to turn them into the very expensive winos?
Well, wouldn't that be a fun option?
I'm sure the person with
the Rolling.
Yeah, I'm sure the person with laryngitis wouldn't be thrilled.
No, he would not. And it's not the Rolling Stones without Jagger up there.
That's true. That is true. Getting back to the film, it's Chuck Lavelle, the Tree Man. I really, really had a fun time watching this film, Chuck. And part of it was hearing your story. And then I kept, as I'm watching it, wondering when it was going to intertwine in with your nickname, with the Tree Man. And it all intertwines together like roots of a tree, pun intended.
Well, I appreciate that, Matthew. You know, that is my other life. I'm equally as passionate about forestry and the environment as I am about music. I love learning. I've considered myself a student of forestry and environmental issues. And, you know, that when we, of course, there's three themes, as you know, to the film. First is the musical career. Secondly, of course, the forestry and environment connection. And third is the love story between my wife, Roselaine, and I.
Yep.
And so, you know, we wanted to blend those things together to try to keep it balanced, you know, not to go too far with either one of the three themes. And I think Alan really did a magnificent job in keeping that balance.
Agreed. Bringing up your lovely wife, it's now, what, 48 years?
That is correct, yes.
48 years. How often does she get to go on tour with you?
Rosie not only tours with me all the time these days, but she, with the Stones, she actually works backstage. We joke that she's one of the chief cat herders, just to get people from A to B. You know, if people have interviews or if they, you know, we have wardrobe, of course, and makeup and all this, and there's schedules to be met. So she helps everybody meet those schedules and get to where they need to be on time. And it's wonderful, you know, we spend a lot of time together. We get to be together on tour. And then when I do my solo shows, she comes with me, and Rose Lane, as you can probably tell from the film, is a true fashionista. she's always been into wardrobe and clothing and style, and so she always helps me get dressed appropriately for whatever event I'm doing.
And number one Chuck groupie.
Yeah, well, I suppose so, and I'm number one Rosie groupie.
There
so
you go. Yeah, exactly.
It works out great. Yeah, we have so much fun together, Matthew. And as I said earlier, over 48 years, you go through a lot of things together. And I think the more you go through, the stronger you get in touch with each other, the more respect you have for each other, and then the more fun you have with each other.
Well, this fall for me will be 22 years, so we're chugging along as well.
Well done, well done.
Thank you. Going back a little bit to your music, what piano players were you listening to as a young student?
Well, very young in our home, my mother she was a piano player, and that's really how I got started, was listening to her. She wasn't a teacher or a professional, but she played, and I loved listening to her play. And she had records by Roger Williams, Ferranti and Teicher, and, kind of those sort of standard artists, I should say. And so, that filtered in. But by the time I started playing myself and being in bands, it would be Leon Russell. It was some of the earlier artists like Little Richard or Jerry Lee Lewis. But later, as I mentioned, Leon, Elton, Nicky Hopkins was certainly a huge influence. Growing up in the South, the Swampers, Barry Beckett, the great piano player that played on so many of those records out of Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Another artist, piano player from that area, Clayton Ivey, great player. I could probably name 1,000 more, but those are some names for you.
And didn't you see Ray Charles in concert when you were 13?
Oh, yeah. How could I not mention Ray? That was a huge event for me. I went along with my sister, who had a date, my older sister, to see Ray Charles, and she kindly dragged me along, or let me come along. And it was such a magnificent performance. Not only Ray himself, who was unbelievable, but the band. You had Fathead Newman on sax. You had Billy Preston playing organ in the band. And Billy was young at the time. And Ray gave Billy a special part of the show where he came out front and sang a song and danced and was just unbelievable. The Raylettes.
Yep.
So it was just the big picture, really. But Ray, of course, stood out above everyone. But it did. It changed my life. I left there because I was playing guitar. I was playing keyboard. I was on the verge of starting my first band, The Misfits, and I thought to myself as I was walking out, man, if I could ever move people like that, not that I would necessarily play that kind of music, but exactly what Ray was doing, but if I could ever be in a band that would move people like that, that's what I want to do.
And wasn't it about 15 you just basically walked up to the doors of Muscle Shoals and let your presence be known?
Well, kind of, sort of. I did have a contact there, a great guy named Marlon Green. Marlon was an engineer there, but Marlon also wrote songs, and he kindly had me work on his first solo record. He was married to Jeannie Green, who was she was a background singer and was on songs by Elvis, recordings by Elvis, and a lot of the other artists that went through Muscle Shoals. She worked a lot in Nashville. So Marlon was my contact, and he would tell me, okay, hey, listen, this session is going on. If you come up and just kind of hang out around this hour, the door will probably open for a break, and then maybe you can come in, meet somebody, maybe sit and play something and see if people listen to you, that
right.
kind of thing. So that's the way it started, and he was very, very gracious to me. And there were others in Muscle Shoals as well that were very encouraging to a young 15, 16-year-old keyboard player.
And your first session, I believe, was with Freddie North?
Yes. David Johnson was the engineer and I think producer as well on that song. Freddie North was a wonderful rhythm and blues artist, and I forget who the songwriter was on that song, because later it became a hit in the country idiom for Johnny Paycheck.
Mm.
But anyway, Freddie was the first one to record it. I played Hammond B3 on it. Great track. And, you know, the record came out. It was the first record I was ever on. So, you know, what a thrill. I mean, it didn't have my name on it, but I could look at that thing, and I knew that I was in those grooves of that vinyl. And it was a big, big deal. You know, of course, nowadays everybody can record in their home or in their basement or wherever. It's just a different day these days. But back then, it was a very big deal to be able to get into a proper studio that had decent equipment and had musical gear, and to work with the other musicians and to make it happen, and then to see the results with it, holding that record in your hand. And lo and behold, that song became a hit. You know, that was the other big deal for me, was hearing it on the radio, thinking, wow, man, you know, I'm on that. It's coming over the radio. That's fantastic.
Have you ever seen the film That Thing You Do?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
It's like that. The first time you hear your song on the radio, the energy that they get out of that.
Yeah, exactly. Tom Hanks was, of course, the
director,
the manager of the band,
yep,
film and everything. Yeah, great stuff. Great stuff. Yeah, that's exactly right. That was the kind of feeling.
So, how much were you then able to do session work, and did you have a band at that time in the evenings?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. I realized, because Muscle Shoals had so many studios, but it also had so many great, great players that were older, more experienced, and I realized that they were going to really get the cream of the recordings, and that I would be probably second, maybe even third fiddle for session work. And, you know, I thought to myself, I wonder if there's an alternative. And that's when I turned my eyes to Macon, Georgia, and Capricorn Records. I had heard about Capricorn. I did have a contact there through Paul Hornsby, who was in the precursor of the Allman Brothers Band, a band called The Hourglass. And that was Greg and Dwayne, Johnny Sandlin, and Pete Carr, and Paul Hornsby was in the band. And so, you know, I said, I want to go check this out, because Paul was already going to go over there. Paul was very much a mentor to me. We had a band together called the South Camp in Tuscaloosa, and he was very helpful to me, taught me a lot, encouraged me. And so when he got called to go to Macon to be a producer and to play on records, I said, I got to go check this out. So I got in my Oldsmobile, 65 Oldsmobile Cutlass station wagon, drove over to Macon, Georgia, saw the state-of-the-art studio, saw a booking agency called Paragon, so they were booking bands as well. Then, of course, the offices of the record company, Capricorn, and that's where my future wife-to-be was working. When the doors opened, there were two beautiful girls there, this beautiful black girl named Carolyn Brown, and my future wife, Rose Lane White. And so, you know, I was so impressed with all of this, and they were encouraging to me. They said, listen, come on over here. We'll find you something to do. You know, we'll put a band together, you know, for guys from Macon and some guys from Tuscaloosa, and that's kind of what happened. We put a band together called Sundown that was half Tuscaloosa guys and half Macon, Georgia guys, and we did one record, and we toured a little bit, not a whole lot, mostly regionally around the South. But during that and subsequent couple of years, I began to get session work, and Paul would hire me to play, Johnny Sandlin would hire me to play, and then eventually we put a band together to back up Alex Taylor, who was James Taylor's elder brother, who was on Capricorn Records. Toured with Alex for a couple of years, did his second record for the label. Eventually that sort of played out, and then Phil Walden had signed Dr. John to a management contract, and Mac, of course, Mac Rebenack is Dr. John's real name. Mac had just recorded In the Right Place, which was the LP.
Right.
And, of course, that had the hit record Right Place, Wrong Time. And so he needed a band to go on tour with, and it was suggested that the same band that back up Alex go ahead and audition for Mac. And we did. We got the gig. And so it was really a matter of just climbing up that ladder. After the Dr. John experience is when I got called in to do the first solo record of Greg Allman's, which was called Laid Back.
Yep.
And that led to some jam sessions with all the Allman Brothers coming down, and that led to me being asked to join the band.
But before I get to the Allmans, I'm glad you brought up Dr. John as well as Greg. When it's a keyboard band leader, how is the dynamic as far as what you're able to contribute? And I mean, do they give you a nod to let you solo here, or what do you do here? And I'm setting this up to get to the solo within the solo, I guess, in Jessica.
Here's the deal. As you know, and most of your listeners know, Dwayne had his tragic motorcycle accident in 1971.
Yep.
It affected everyone, not just everyone in the band, but Dwayne was kind of the spiritual leader, if you will, of all the acts that were on Capricorn. And it was a huge blow to the entire community. And then the band, the Allmans, had some contracts to fulfill on concerts that were on the books, and they went out as a five-piece band without any replacement. And you don't replace Dwayne Allman anyway. So, and can you imagine the pressure on Dickie Betts, because
right.
he had never played slide guitar before, and now he had to carry the whole thing on his own. They came off of that little short tour in, I guess it would have been sometime in maybe spring of 72, physically exhausted, mentally exhausted, just drained. And that's the reason they wanted to take a break, and that's the reason Greg wanted to do a solo record, just do something different, you know, career-wise. And so during these jam sessions that I mentioned in the course of recording the Laid Back record, you know, I was there. What was I going to do but join in and have some fun and play? And I think what it did for everybody was took it in a totally different direction. You know, as I said earlier, you don't replace Dwayne Allman on guitar. I think that would have been a mistake to, you know, even if you had a brilliant guitar player, maybe someone with a big name, it just wouldn't have been the same. But to take a different instrument and take it into a slightly different direction, that's what made sense. And it gave everybody a comfort level. It was really exciting for me. I mean, I was playing with an established band, and they were really talented and great, and they had wonderful songs. And so, you know, the door was wide open, man. They said, listen, you know, if we're going to get you in the band, we want you to play. I mean, don't be a wallflower, you know, get out there and do what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way it went. And of course, you mentioned Jessica. When that came up, and we were discussing the arrangement, and everybody agreed that I needed a vehicle in there. This was the star instrumental of the, as you know, the Allman Brothers pretty much had an instrumental on every record they did, even after tenure with the band. And so it was part of the scenario, and Jessica was the one this time, and it was just a great vehicle for a piano. And I did my best to step up to the plate on it.
Well, I stole the term from Billy Bob Thornton, who was also interviewed in the documentary. I love that term because, as he mentioned, it's like a solo within a solo if you're into Inception. But it's, yeah, I mean, somewhere in the world. I guess I should say, just a reminder to listeners, you're listening to Film Sociology here at WFYI.org. I'm talking with Chuck Lavelle, keyboardist extraordinaire and subject of the documentary Chuck Lavelle, the Tree Man. And somewhere in the world on a radio or a satellite radio, your work is being played right this second.
Well, you know, that's a good feeling. I've been so blessed, Matthew, throughout my career. And, you know, to have some degree of success with one artist or in one band, would be brilliant. I think any musician would be happy with that. But the great joy of my career has been that one thing has led to another, and I've been able to work with just a wide range of very interesting and diverse artists.
Well, and I know there was kind of, you know, as you mentioned, life is kind of ups and downs. I know there was the combination of the Almonds taking basically just stopping performing and touring, and then Capricorn Records folded. But then some guys from England got in touch with you.
Yeah, there was some stuff in between, but I'll tell this. I'll tell this story, which I, you know, I guess spoiler alert.
If you want, I mean, you know.
Countries will.
Yeah.
No, I don't mind.
Okay.
So my wife had inherited some land. This is in 1981. And I began this interest in looking after the land. And so I began to study a little bit, go to the library, check out books on land use, talk to other people, go to meetings and seminars, just try to soak in anything I could. And at the same time, my musical career was kind of, the faucet had shut down. I had a little trio. I was playing clubs. The phone wasn't ringing for session work. As you mentioned, Capricorn Records had gone bankrupt. So we were kind of just hanging in the wind there. And I came home one day rather frustrated and talking to Rose Lane, my wife, and I said, you know, Rosie, I'm never going to quit music. I'm always going to play. But the phone's not ringing, and the action's just not there. I'm tired of playing these little clubs, and, you know, I'm very interested in what's going on with the land. I want to learn more about it. Maybe I should just kind of let things go where they want to go and just focus on the land for a while. And she listened very patiently and said, well, that's interesting, Chuck, but guess what? The Rolling Stones called you today. absolutely true story. And, you know, at first I thought she was pulling my leg, and but she said, no, I'm telling you the truth. Here's the phone number. There's the phone. Go dial this number. And I did. And within about several hours, I got a call back from Ian Stewart, who, of course, was a great piano player himself and who was really one of the founding members of the Rolling Stones that wound up doing a number of duties with the band, including logistics and so he was the one that made contact after I did that initial call. And I did have a club show that weekend, and I said, it's like a Thursday, and I said, well, Stu, can I, you know, I'm honored, I'm flattered. Yeah, of course I want to come up. Can I come up on Monday? I got a little gig this weekend. He said, we'd really like to have you there tomorrow. You know, what could I do? I called the club. They understood. They were very understanding. The next day I was on a plane to audition.
Nice. And eventually you got the gig, right?
Correct. I didn't get it immediately. The audition was great. I mean, it was supposed to be one day. They kept me there 3 days. Everybody, I loved it. I got the feeling that they enjoyed what I was doing and contributing to them. But the truth was, Ian McLagan, who, of course, was a keyboard player in The Faces with Ronnie Wood,
yep,
had done the previous tour. And, you know, so the odds were on Mac, on Ian. And, you know, Stu finally called me back and he said, listen, you know, the guys love what you did. And it was a kind of a debate within the band, but they've decided to keep Mac on for this tour. And we'll see what happens. So, you know, I was disappointed naturally, but the band went on tour in the U.S. They came to Atlanta and did an unannounced show at the Fox Theater. Stu called me up. He said, would you like to come up and have a little bit of a blast? And I said, yes, I would. So I went up. I sat in on, you know, three or four songs with the band at the Fox. That went really well. And that's also started the friendship between Mac and myself, Ian McLagan and myself. He was just so sweet and gracious. And so we stayed in touch after that. But for the summer tour the following year, 1982, Stu called me up and he said, this time you're on, mate. Everybody wants you. Come on. And at the same time, Mac had made some commitments to Bonnie Raitt. So, you know, thank you, Bonnie. Thank you, Mac. Thank you, Rolling Stones.
Well, and I think part of this business is obviously the ability, knowing folks, timing, and patience, and a good reputation.
Well, I would agree with all of that. You know, my dad old sayings was a big deal around our house. And one of the things my dad used to say is, you make your own luck.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? I think it means learning how to be, well, one of the things it means is learning how to be in the right place at the right time, knowing, you know, when to speak up, when to listen. And, you know, that old saying has served me very well in my entire career. So, yes, and the other thing is the five P's. Proper preparation prevents poor performance. I love that one. So, you know, be prepared, do your homework, and then when you get into the situation, be gracious, do a lot of listening, and make your own luck.
What's the backstage environment like at a Stones concert or Stones tour?
Well, it's a lot different these days. When I first joined, it was more wide open. There were more guests allowed in the backstage area. It was very elaborate. My heavens, the money that was spent on the backstage was just insane. And it was great for the times. It served its purpose, I suppose, in certain ways. But in reality, it was overkill. It was just way too much. And I think it, to a degree, it sort of distracted from the preparation of doing the show. So these days, it's more locked down, more individual. You know, I share a dressing room with Daryl Jones. We do our thing in our dressing room. You know, we mingle between dressing rooms, of course, and there's certainly a feeling of camaraderie. But everybody has duties, you know.
Yep.
I prepare the set list. I do a draft of the set list. I look back at what we played in any given city the time before we were there, or both two times before we were there. Try to make things make sense. I get up with Mick right after the sound check and get his thoughts on it. If Keith, you know, run it by Keith, and if Keith has any comments, and we all finally agree on that. So, you know, these things take time, and you're focused on your business at hand.
There's always a lot of are you always trying to put in Out of Tears or Shine of Light just so we can hear your piano in those?
You know, it's a tough thing. There's such a body of work. I mean,
yep.
There's no, you know, you could do an 8-hour show if you wanted to. And the other reality, look, you know, we're all of a certain age these days, and so you can't do that. Well, you know, it's not practical to do a 3-hour show anymore. So
right.
We're kind of at the 2-hour gate now. So you got to look at how many songs can you get in 2 hours. And then you got to look at the icon songs, because look, the hardcore fans, I get comments all the time over the net on the various different groups that follow the Rolling Stones. And I take a lot of heat from that because, oh, he does a set list, and I'm tired of hearing Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Oh,
I'm tired
geez.
Of hearing Start Me Up. I could never hear, you know, be happy if I never heard it again. Well, that's the hardcores, and I understand that. You know, they'd love to hear Soul Survivor, you know, or
the entire
Casino Boogie. Or
yeah, the entire Exile album.
Of course.
Yeah.
And I get that, but can you imagine the tens of thousands of people that walk out, you know, that would be upset, I should say, if they didn't hear Jumpin' Jack, if they didn't hear Start Me Up, if they didn't hear Can't Always Get What You Want, you
right.
know, if they didn't hear Satisfaction.
I think it's
a challenge.
I think it's the ratio of diehards compared to people who had not seen the Rolling Stones in concert. And that's with any group, really. You know, whether it's Eric Clapton or the Allman Brothers, certain songs sort of have to be done or done in a different way or varies. But yeah, I mean, I think the number of people who have never seen them before compared to somebody who's seen them 20 times and are burnt out on Jumpin' Jack Flash. I think that's just how that is.
Well, it is. Absolutely. And there's, you have to appreciate the genre as well. Now, you know, an Allman Brothers band is more in the jam band genre, and they're kind of known, those bands are known for not doing the same set the same song, you know, in a 3, 4, 5 concert period. And I get that, and that's the way it works for those fans and for those bands. But with a band like the Stones that have had so many hit records like
yep.
that, you know, that's a different story.
And how was the experience of touring with Eric Clapton?
Oh, man, it was just so wonderful. He was a special guest on, I think it was maybe five, maybe even six concerts of the Steel Wheels Tour,
yep.
1989. They set him up next to me on stage, and the song that we did, I think it was every time, was Little Red Rooster, so a
yep.
great blues song, Howlin' Wolf. And we had a very nice musical communication, conversation between the two of us. You know, it was all about Eric, but I tried to throw a lick in there every now and then, let him know I was there, you know. So anyway, I get home from that tour, and there's a message on my answering machine. Hello, this is Eric Clapton calling Chuck Lavelle from Hong Kong to see if he might be interested in playing some shows at the Royal Albert Hall. Yes, I would be very interested in that, Eric. So I went in. I tried to do my homework. They sent me some information about what most of the set would be, most of the songs. Great band. Are you kidding?
Oh, yeah.
Steve Ferroni on drums, Nathan East on bass, and Andy Fairweather Lowe on guitar, and Katie Kassoon and Tessa Niles singing, and Ray Cooper on percussion, Greg Filling Games, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So, I tried to remember to make my own luck and to do a lot of listening and to do my best to fit in and do what was asked of me, but also trying to contribute. So as time went on, and there's a long story to be told, but let's just go a little fast forward. Greg decided he would like to stay at home more, produce records, be in the LA area, do sessions. And he resigned, very amicably. And Eric came to me and he said, listen, Greg's decided he doesn't want a tour. We're going to do this unplugged show. And how do you feel about it? Do you think you'd be okay on your own? Or do you think we should look for another keyboard player? And I said, Eric, you know what? If it's all the same to you, I'd just love to have it to myself for a while. And that's what happened. So, you know, that gave me a chance. The gates were open. I was able to have more of a forefront role from that time on with Eric, and it was great. I mean, the unplugged thing is still his best-selling record.
Yep, and you got the show off a little bit on Alberta.
A little bit on Alberta and Old Love.
Yep.
Some of the other ones. So it was a great experience.
I was going through my own concert history, trying to figure out where I had seen you live. And it comes down to a couple things. But before I ask that, I want to know, movie-wise, Chuck, are there character actors that you enjoy watching no matter what the film is?
No, sure. Yeah, I understand.
Okay, because you know, for session players, I've always said, have been like the character actors of the music world, where you hear their stuff, you like their stuff, and then after a while, you hopefully recognize their look or their sound, and then there's that wonderful moment when you have a that guy or that lady's name committed to memory. And I think, at least in my life, Chuck, you're an example of that. I got to see the Stones on the Steel Wheels tour in Indianapolis, and I'm trying to remember because I know there was another keyboardist, but you were on that full tour. Am I right?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, Matt Clifford was the other keyboardist.
Okay,
he handled most of the synthesizer type
roles. Okay, so yeah, I knew it. So you were on full piano. So I got to see you in Indy. There were two shows, and I was not at the one where Corey Glover of Living Color fell off the world's largest concert stage, but I was at the other show, and that was fun. Well, and that's the other thing, I guess, Chuck, before I get into it, is, you know, you get people coming up to you all the time going, I saw you in this city with this band on that year. As far as your memory of so, is it more individual moments as opposed to an entire show when it comes to recollection?
Yeah, man. I mean, look, I don't have the strongest memory in the world, and you have to appreciate, on the last tour, I tried to count up, or actually somebody else had counted up the number of shows since I joined the band, and it was like well over 1,000. And so when you think about that, and you think about all the rehearsals, and then you think of the other artists you've worked with, I mean, there's no way to remember everything. But there are certainly standout moments.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
And I think with, you know, from an audience standpoint, if they meet you or they see you, it's, you know, for them, it's, you know, meeting you, it's seconds or minutes at a moment. And for you, it's the umpteenth person that you've met or seen that day. I know you were, I saw you in Indianapolis with Eric Clapton, because if I remember correctly, you were assigned to do the high vocal points on White Room.
Well, that's right. That's right. Greg used to do it when he was in the band, and when he left, you know, Eric looked at me and said, "Can you do this?" And I said, "Well, I'll give it a shot. You tell me if I can do it." So, I got to do that bit, and that was a great honor for me. And you know, the same occurred on this tour that we did with David Gilmour.
Yeah.
For Comfortably Numb. You know, he turned to me and he said, "Do you want to sing on this?" And I thought he may have meant just to on the choruses or whatever. And I said, "Sure, I'll sing." And he said, "Well, you do the counterpart." Okay. but that was a great honor as well.
I say, and when did you know that, because I didn't know this until I watched the film, that David Gilmour was a big tree enthusiast.
Yeah, well, I didn't either until we met and spent time. And actually, when we confirmed that I was going to do the tour, he put something on his website about the fact that, you know, my other life is a tree farmer and dedication to forestry and the environment. And that makes him my new favorite person. So that was a great compliment. And then when we got to know each other, and actually I went to his home, Rosie and I went to his house in the country. Of course, he's got more than one house, but he has a beautiful place in the country in England, and boy, he's just manicured it, and he has some beautiful cherry trees and other trees that he's planted there. And he also does a bit of woodworking as well, which is cool.
I was about to say, they're in the documentary, Chuck Lavelle, The Tree Man. I had never seen this before, but I knew I'd heard of him, but we get to see you do a controlled burn. How much training does that take?
Yep. Well, you know, you have to know what you're doing, and there's so many aspects to it. Just for instance, you have to understand how much moisture is in the ground or not, how much litter is on the ground, what the wind speed and direction is, what the relative humidity is. What you don't want to do is burn when the humidity is very low, because things are dry. They can crisp up and you know, heat up very quickly. There is an art to it, and it's not for the faint of heart, and it does take training. So, but at this juncture, you know, I've done it quite a lot. I do it every year on our place, and it can be an extremely effective tool.
Have you heard of, are you familiar with the Music Maker Relief Foundation?
Vaguely.
Okay. It's an organization out in the Carolinas, but they just put out back in 2020, they put out an album and a book called Hanging Tree Guitars. And it's a gentleman who makes guitars out of trees that were actually used for lynchings back in the 20th century.
Oh, my goodness. No, I didn't know that about them. Yeah, well, that's interesting.
If you get a chance, look for that. Something else I didn't know was when there's the bringing Rosie back into the conversation. I loved you two strolling around Paris. That could be an extra short film in and of itself, or a travelogue. But also you finding out that I didn't know that all the trees in Paris are documented. Who does that job?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, Paris is known as the City of Lights, and it certainly is, but. It has a great history of looking after its trees, you know, even through the days of the kings and queens. And and they're very meticulous about it. And everything is documented. Every tree in the city limits is documented and looked after. And you know, if something shows up with a bit of disease a tree dies from natural causes or from other causes, you know, they're very quick to remove it and to replace it. You know, not too many cities in the world are that dedicated to their trees, so it's pretty special.
Exactly. Jumping back, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org, talking with Chuck Lavelle. And by the way, when did Lavelle become Lavelle in your mind?
Well, here's the deal. I grew up as a Lavelle. a lot of people that spell my name, my last name that way, pronounce it Lavelle. Some do not. But here's the deal. So when I joined the Allman Brothers Band, you know, Greg was a very shy person. He didn't really like doing interviews. Vicky sort of shunned him as well. But as the band became, you know, ever popular, and we were requested to do radio interviews especially, I'd go on air. You know, they'd say, well, Chuck will do it. You know, you go do it. It's okay. And I'd go on the air, and the guy would look at my name and he'd say, well, I'm here with Chuck Lavelle. And I came to prefer that pronunciation. The actual derivative of the name is Lavelle of the Village.
Hmm.
And so it got twisted and turned through the centuries to Lavelle or Lavelle. But, you know, I prefer Lavelle.
That's good. Well, here in Indianapolis, we had the great blues mandolin player Yank Rochelle. And there were times, even in his own songs, that he would refer to himself as Rachel or Rochelle. And I finally went to his years ago, I went to his granddaughter and I said, which pronunciation is it? And her answer was, if you're from the north, it's Rochelle. If you're from the south, it's Rachel. Either way, you're still talking about him.
we're the same person, no matter how you pronounce it.
Yeah, exactly. Also in the film, I love the fact that I think it's your daughter that refers to you as the Forrest Gump of classic rock.
Yeah, that was a surprise to me. It was actually her brother-in-law, who is the brother of my son-in-law, that made that comment, and it stuck with Amy, and, you know, she used it on the camera, and I thought, well, that's, you know, and I've had a lot of comments from people that have seen the film that say that's a standout line, and so I don't mind it.
No, I think it's like, I mentioned before how the three stories in the documentary are rooted like a tree. I also think of those great band tree posters that intertwine with one another. And I'm, you know, you have a very crooked path, I'm sure, sir.
Well, you know, look, it's just been a blessing, Matthew. And still going strong. You know, I can't wait to get past this COVID era when
yep.
we can all go work again. I miss doing my solo shows. I miss doing shows with my band. Certainly miss my British brethren. And, you know, who knows when this thing is going to clear up. The vaccines are out there now. I've had my second shot, thank heavens, and Roseline has. And so, listen, our first move is to go see family that we haven't seen in over a year now, grandchildren, and so we're excited about that. But I don't think it's going to be all that much longer. Maybe the fall. It depends on how fast these vaccinations circulate and how fast people get comfortable with going
yep.
into stadiums and big arenas again.
Yep, absolutely. So, but for the time being, you can check out Chuck Lavelle, The Tree Man. It's available on many streaming services. Like I said, I got to see it last week and thoroughly enjoyed it. And by the way, I know we talked before I started rolling tape, but I have to tell you, between seeing you with the Stones in 1989, and I was reminded fairly quickly that in one of the first albums I bought in the 90s and became one of the most important albums for me in my college years was the Black Crowes album, Shake Your Moneymaker, which you were all over.
Yeah, I think, didn't that album just have an anniversary of some type?
They're doing a reissue, yeah.
Oh, God.
And
40th maybe? Oh, my
30th.
Heavens,
oh, no, 30th. 30th. But
30th,
it was
okay. I feel better now.
Yes.
Thank you for correcting.
Yeah, you're a decade younger, Chuck. But no, I think it was Chris Robinson that said, you know, he originally was going to have you on a couple of tunes, and then they just kept asking you to come back in. Does that happen quite a bit when you go to the studio?
Well, it certainly did on that record. George Draculius was the producer, and he contacted me and said, look, there's this Atlanta band. They were actually called Mr. Crow's Garden at the time. And we're going to do a record on them, and they asked me if there's any possibility of getting you on it. And I said, well, you know, let me listen to what it is. He played me this really raw rehearsal tape. But I could hear the energy, and I could hear that they had something. So I said, yeah, man, I'd love to. And then things got postponed and postponed. I was literally the next day going on tour, flying to Europe to meet up with the Stones. And this was the last possible day that we could do it. And so I went to Atlanta, and it was like, well, there's these two songs, and let's do piano on this and organ on that. Well, I do piano, and they said, well, that sounded great. Maybe you could put organ on that, too. Well, there's organ on this one, and maybe you could put piano on it. Yeah, and, well, we got this other song. How much time you got? So it wound up being, more than half the record. But, listen, I love those guys, and I love the music. Chris and Rich, talented cats.
Yep.
It was a great honor, and I'm glad I was there.
And as I was saying, between getting into the Rolling Stones at age 18 and then the Black Crowes, that changed my music path. And I'm eternally grateful for that and for you, my friend. Thank you so much.
Matthew, it's been a joy. I really appreciate you. Let's do it again sometime.
I would like that. In fact, what was it? I mentioned before how session players are certain musicians are the character actors of the world. As soon as I realized, I didn't know until the film that you also played on Drops of Jupiter. And as soon as I heard that, I went, oh, well, of course that's Chuck Lavelle's piano. Why not?
Well, there you go. That was a lot of fun as well. That's a great song.
Yeah, I'm delaying. I'm sorry. But the last moment in the film where you're performing Georgia on My Mind, that's on your property?
Yes, it is. Yes. I have my main piano is in what we call the lodge, and I go there to practice. And Alan had this idea, let's put it outdoors because it makes the connection of my environmental stuff. And I said, yeah, great idea. So let's do that. And it was not all that far from the lodge itself, but probably 200 yards or so out the back door.
Okay. The documentary is called Chuck Lavelle, the Tree Man. Go look for it. You'll be all the better for it.
Matthew, thanks again, my brother. Really, you're an easy guy to talk to. I had a great time. Thanks to all of your listeners, and here's to next time.
From last year, my interview with Chuck Lavelle. So mighty, mighty fine stuff there. You can go to Chuck Lavelle, thetreeman.com, LEAVELL, Chuck Lavelle, thetreeman.com, to learn more about the documentary and Forrest and family and music from Chuck Lavelle. Very cool guy. And of course, reminder, WFYI.org/give or call 877-930-0221. Before we grab a pencil and find out what you've been watching, want to raise a glass to Hong Kong actor Kenneth Sang, who passed away earlier this week. He started out in movies as a teenager, with films going back to the 1950s. Films like The Feud and Who Isn't Romantic. Diehard movie nerds know him from John Woo's films A Better Tomorrow, 1 and 2. Once a Thief. Made his Hollywood debut in The Replacement Killers, was also in Rush Hour 2 and Die Another Day, among others. So here's to you, Kenna. Thank you so much for your work. Over at IU Cinema on Sunday, Friday, 7 o'clock, if you're listening to the show early, from 1952, the comedy Has Anybody Seen My Gal? Sunday, May 1st, recently added new 4K restoration of the 1979 documentary The Wobblies. There will be a post-screening Q&A with IU professor Alec Lichtenstein and IU professor and IU AAUP president Ben Robinson on Sunday, May 1st at 1 o'clock. Tuesday, May 3rd, a virtual event at 7 o'clock, the Monthly Movie Roundup Virtual Edition. That is happening over at IU Cinema. At the Can-Can this weekend, everything, everywhere, all at once. Please go see this film. See it in the theater if you're comfortable. It's worth it. The Northman is also in theaters over at the Can-Can, as well as We're All Going to the World's Fair. That is happening over at the Can-Can. At the Art Craft Theater in Franklin, the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. 7:30, April 29th, if you're listening quickly, 10 Things I Hate About You. On Saturday the 30th at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., Cartoons for Cans. So six cartoons per show. Admission is one canned or non-perishable food item, goods, that is, then will go to the Interchurch Food Pantry. So that's a 10 a.m., 2 p.m. on April 30th. Saturday at 7:30 p.m., Conan the Barbarian. I just saw a picture of Sandahl Bergman online recently. She's working the front door of the Blues House Party. mark your calendars, May 6th and 7th, 2 and 7:30 p.m. next Friday and Saturday, The Last of the Mohicans. May 13th and 14th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And on Thursday, May 19th, that's a senior series, sorry. And if you're with the Swartz Family Community Mortuary, you're in good hands. No, Friday and Saturday, May 21st and 22nd, 2 and 7:30 p.m., the 1957 film version of 310 to Yuma, written by film sociology guest Elmore Leonard. That, oh, man, that's, and I don't mind, I like the remake, but yeah, I really dig the original 310 to Yuma. May 27th and 28th at 2 and 7:30 p.m., Clue. All of that is at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. Down in Bloomington, Friday, May 6th, it is movie night at the Artisan Alley in Bloomington, Indiana. Block of films at 6:30, 7:15, 8 o'clock. You can go to happeningnext.com, I believe, or Artisan Alley for more information on that. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. All right, friends, grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching this week. Hopefully you've been able to watch some good films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. And part of the this has been just a fun bit to do for over 2 years now, and because, you know, at first out of necessity, and now it's just become a part of the show. And part of the reason why we grab a pencil and we throw titles at each other is because of your listenership and your support. So thank you. WFYI.org/give, 877-930-0221. And here we go. We start with Jamie, who writes, "This week I watched Justice League Dark." Judy writes, "The Batman," and in parentheses, "so not a small film." Okay. I'm going to share this, a little inside baseball with you here at Film Sociology. My buddy Judy and I worked at the Reporter Progress newspapers together way back in the 90s, the late 90s, in Downers Grove, Illinois. And I love you, Judy. So we had a reporter, a young cub reporter, fresh out of college, and she didn't last long, by the way. And there were just moments that Judy wanted to take this reporter and just pound her into the dirt, like Lucy Van Pelt. And there was already talk about the making of Phantom Menace. So that came out in 99. That we're looking at probably 1998 when this was going on, when this conversation happened. And I had heard that Ewan McGregor was going to be cast as young Obi-Wan Kenobi, which I thought was inspired casting. And Judy had asked about this actor. And at that time, he was the art house darling. And this reporter, who will remain nameless, kind of chimed in and said to Judy, "You wouldn't know him. He's only done small films." And I thought Judy was going to give this reporter the stone cold stunner. To be fair, at the time, he had, in the last couple of years in his career, he had become, like I said, the art house darling. He was in Shallow. He had already done Shallow Grave, Trainspotting, Pillow Book, Come Off the Bench in Emma, appeared in Brassed Off, Night Watch. His first kind of studio Hollywood film, A Life Less Ordinary, although not a lot of people saw that, Velvet Goldmine, and Little Voice. So, yeah, there's that streak of 90s European art films. And but yeah, the look on Judy's face. Again, if you've ever watched Peanuts, she was looking at this reporter like Lucy was looking at Linus. So anyway, that's a running bit that's been going for 20 years. So thank you, Judy. I'm glad you saw The Batman, not a small film. Moving on, Dustin writes, The Hustler, the TV film version of Jake's Women and Sinatra in Palm Springs. Tiffany writes, I watched The Batman and loved it. Joshua writes, oh boy, I spent some time with Harry Callahan and the Conjuring Universe. Two separate entities, gang. The Enforcer, Sudden Impact, Annabelle, Annabelle Creation, Annabelle Comes Home, and The Curse of La Llorona. Man, Joshua, whew. And yes, I watched Restaurant Impossible last night, of course. Abby writes, finally watched The Batman. Daniel writes, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, Live Flesh, The Night House, Victi, Christina Barcelona, and Ash Wednesday. Doug writes, two from 1936, Come and Get It and My Man Godfrey, and four Hitchcocks, Murder, The Man Who Knew Too Much, Suspicion, and To Catch a Thief. Annie writes, Cry Wolf. Wow, Craig. Okay, so Craig, my buddy Craig, saw a performance last week. This week, he watched Ken Russell's Listomania. I've said this before on the show, and just a reminder, I unabashedly love the films of Ken Russell. He is truly bonkers, and Listomania is. This was his follow-up to Tommy with Roger Daltrey playing a Hungarian composer Franz Liszt. Of course, with Russell's imagination, deemed him the first music rock superstar. Sorry, Amadeus. And there's also things of, let's see, moments of him, of Liszt riding a giant phallus because of groupies. Ringo Starr shows up as a pope. Wagner, there's elements of Hitler and Frankenstein for Wagner. It's not a subtle film. And Ken Russell, like I said, he was a loon. He had his own zip code, and I love watching his films. So yeah, way to go, Craig. Listomania, man. Hey, Criterion. Channing writes, Celine and Julie go boating and Mulholland Drive. Eric writes, we rewatched Chef. Great grilled cheese there, Eric. Dave writes, Fight Club and The English Patient. David writes, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, The Other Guys for about the eighth time, and The Unforgivable. JJ writes, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, The Conversation, The Last Picture Show, and Three Kings. Cassie writes, Moana. Eric writes, The Batman and Dark Shadows. Abby writes, Licorice Pizza, and then Don't Recommend. Aw, come on, Abby. Really? Abby, call me, or else I will call you and... I'm not going to film splain to you, but oh, that bums me out. I'm sorry. Sorry you didn't like it. We did. Emma and I did. Scott writes, we watched Exodus with Paul Newman. Tony writes, mostly Martha and Rosemary's Baby. Megan writes, we still don't have TV/internet, but thanks for asking. These are my listeners, friends. Molly writes, Cymbeline from 2014. Ed Harris as the king of a biker gang. Dakota Johnson as Imogen. Molly, I actually own Cymbeline. Yeah, that also has Ethan Hawke and Mila Jovovich. Yeah, it's an oddity, but not a lot of people do Cymbeline, so there's that. Molly also watched Polar, An American Pickle, Jimmy Savile, A British Horror Story. Yeah, I'm on episode 2 of Jimmy Savile, A British Horror Story, Molly. And yeah, I hope your shower was as good as mine. The Speed Cubers and The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Kurt writes, Funny Girl for the Belle Trace movie right around Streisand's birthday. Nice. Amanda writes, The Last Dance, or One Last Dance, as well as... Reading Patrick Swayze, Lisa Niemi, The Time of My Life. Oh, very good. Dylan writes, Animal Crackers, Harold and Maude, and She-Mob. I just love introducing people to this lovely trash fest. Thank you, Dylan. It's always good to introduce people to trashy films, lovely trashy films. Alice writes, The Last Jedi. Robert Muggy writes, All That Heaven Allows, Written in the Wind, Imitation of Life, and Magnificent Obsession by Douglas Sirk. Mulholland Drive and Blue Velvet by David Lynch, Lost Horizon by Frank Capra, and Mississippi Mermaid by Francois Truffaut. Late 60s, Catherine Deneuve. And then there's a nice little thread with Terry and Robert talking. I love my thread. Taylor writes, Red, The Spy Who Dumped Me, The Widow, Oh, The Window, sorry. All three versions of Death on the Nile. Whew, and Andrew Blake's Secrets. Cassandra writes, we are beginning the journey of watching the MCU films in release order. So far, we've seen Iron Man, Iron Man 2, and Thor. We had to skip Hulk for now, as it's not on Disney Plus, and we're waiting for it to be returned to the library to check out. Good luck, Cassandra. That's how they get you. Oh, I forgot. We also watched Death on the Nile the week before, but I missed commenting on your post last week. It's okay, Cassandra. It's fine. I read it. It's cool. Eric writes, The Adam Project, The 7-Ups, underrated car chase. I know people talk about Bullet and The French Connection and Vanishing Point, but yeah, don't forget The 7-Ups. Don't fall asleep on The 7-Ups. That's really good. Leon the Professional, first time Eric's watched that since 1996. Plus, wrapped up season 5 of Friday Night Lights and binging Apple TV's amazing Orwellian Kafka-esque Severance, which he says is highly recommended. Diana writes, rewatch the documentary Nows with Fred Armisen and Bill Hader. Brilliant. Yeah, I love documentary Now. That just cracks me up, Diana. Good call. Aaron writes, everything, everywhere, all at once. John writes, The Bombardment. Terry writes, Happy Hour and Asako 1 and 2. And then there's a conversation with Robert and Terry on the thread. I love this. Britt writes, Bram Stoker's Dracula. Michael writes, The Batman, The Living Daylights, and Phantom of Chinatown. Catherine writes, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, best movie of 2022. So far, I'm with you, Catherine. Yes, still early in the year. But yeah, it's the first great film of 2022. Thank you, Catherine. Zachariah writes, The Magician. Gary writes, Salad Days, A Decade of Punk in Washington, D.C. The Professional, Black Mountainside, Puppet Master 3. Zombies. Haunting of Cell Block 11. Dead and Deader. The La Llorona Curse. Breadcrumbs. Birdemic. Riff Tracks treatment of Birdemic. Very good. Slink and the Adicet. David writes, rewatch The Batman, first the soundtrack. Okay. Keith writes, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, 2011. 300, The Protégé, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, The Last Case of August E. Harrison, and the Millennium Trilogy. Linda writes, maybe next week. Okay, Linda, sure. Mike writes, Before Sunrise. Patty writes, Wolfwalkers, The Dawn Patrol, and Cry Wolf. All are films I have never seen before. Way to go, Patty. And I want to get you on the show very soon, Patty, about a film we need to talk about. Teresa writes, Starman. Scott writes, Gattaca. Joe writes, To Kill a Mockingbird. Melissa writes, Run. And finally, Leslie writes, Secondhand Lions. And there you go, friends. That's what you've been watching this week. So hopefully you found some films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as good quality stuff, as well as falling back on old favorites. And I love the conversations that happen on the page and the titles. Somebody will say, I watched so-and-so because you brought it up, and vice versa. So very, very cool. Now I have Listomania on the head. Thanks, Craig. Anyway, good work every week, friends. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. And just coming in under the wire, Chris writes, The Great Moment, Hatching, Aeneas in Love, Aline, The Bad Guys, Charlotte, and We're All Going to the World's Fair. It's all in the timing, friends. And check out the film app. You really should. Anyway, thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting Film Sociology. Thank you for contributing to the Grab a Pencil portion. And if you enjoy Film Sociology, and if you've ever contributed to the Grab a Pencil portion of the show, please consider going to wfyi.org/give or calling 877-930-0221. That's where you can go to become a member, to renew your membership, or to become a sustaining member and support Film Sociology, WFYI, and all things public radio goodness. We'll do this again next week. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
when I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!